Good evening, and welcome to The Bookshelf. This is Mike Ailman. And this week I have the privilege and the joy of reading a series of short stories which I wrote and which appear in my book, Adios Mi Abuela and Other Stories. Adios Mi Abuela and the other stories in the book feature a Mexican-American family and a boy named Ricardo Vega, who has a close and interesting relationship with his grandparents. El Día de los Muertos, which means the Day of the Dead, whom we call Halloween. Throughout her life, Ricardo's grandmother insisted that it was bad luck to get married on Halloween. Es el Día de los Muertos, she said, the Day of the Dead. She spoke in Spanish almost exclusively, as she'd been raised in Juarez before moving north to El Paso as a young woman to live with Ricardo's grandfather, a former member of Pancho Villa's gang. They never married, but established a common law marriage in the United States. They were together more or less for the rest of their lives, although Pa left periodically on drunken binges that kept him away from 6 months to a year or more. Some family members laughed at Ma's superstitions, brushing them off as the wanderings of an old Mexican woman. But Ricardo took them seriously. He knew the power of his grandmother's knowledge. After all, when he had a fever and she put a raw egg in a dish under his bed, by morning the fever was broken. So when it was announced that Luisa Sanchez was getting married at St. Teresa's on Saturday, October 31st, Ma refused to attend the wedding. Es malo, she said, it's bad. This wedding is no good. I stay. Ricardo's father insisted the whole family attend, so Ricardo didn't have the option to refuse. He immediately began saying Hail Marys by the dozens to ward off the evil certain to interfere with the wedding. Halloween had always been one of Ricardo's favorite days, a careful marriage of excitement and fear. He anticipated the changing of the leaves, when the first subtle beginnings of the season showed itself in faint yellow in the tops of the oaks and maples. He laughed in the face of sudden winds during the late innings of an afternoon baseball game, and he welcomed Halloween night itself, when he could hide behind a legitimate mask and become a masked marauder or a heroic member of the Justice League of America. In Ricardo's neighborhood, a gang of older guys, late teens to early 20s, hung out on the corners from the early warmth of May until the night given in October, when it no longer seemed worth the cold to leer at the women and girls or intimidate males of any age who passed by. The gang shot craps, drank cokes, hustled women, or defended their turf from outsiders who foolishly wandered through in search of a little excitement. The gang had no name, but had become at one and the same time the admiration of younger teens and the curse of parents in the neighborhood. Ricardo, along with the other boys, heard all too often his father swear he'd beat the hell out of Ricardo if he ever caught him hanging out on the corner with that gang. Despite the threat, however, hanging out was a dream to be fulfilled, and every young kid sought ways to insert himself into the corner society so that when the time was right, he could become a full-fledged member of the gang. Ricardo was no exception and managed one windy day to seize his opportunity and make a name for himself among his buddies as well as with the gang itself. On an early September evening, just after school started, Ricardo was draped over his neighbor's pipe fence watching the gang shoot craps. It was breezy, requiring the players to use the change to hold down the paper money they were passing around in winning and losing. Ricardo studied them with great spectator's interest, practicing their crouch and movements as they rolled the dice or collected their winnings. He hungered for a black leather jacket, for faded blue jeans worn low on the hips, for a white T-shirt with a pack of Luckies rolled in the short sleeve, for black penny loafers worn with white socks. So there was Ricardo entwined in his neighbor's pipe fence, his leg hooked over the middle rung, his skinny arms draped over the top rung, his chin resting on it, watching them shoot craps in this breezy fall evening when a fortuitous gust of wind blew the paper money into the air, sending some of it scurrying like dead leaves through the yard to Ricardo, who intuitively stamped his foot down on a $20 bill, and just as intuitively, he scooped up the bill, magically disengaged himself from the fence, and streaked for the safety of home, just a few quick steps away. Once on the porch, He turned to see who was in hot pursuit, only to discover that the gang, to a man, remained on the corner staring incredulously as if the Holy Mother herself were standing at his side with a protective arm thrown over his shoulder. He heard a burst of laughter. He heard someone say, "Christ," and another voice say, "The balls." Finally, one of the gang members began to take careful, deliberate steps toward Ricardo, who finally realized that regardless of the presence of the Holy Mother and her notable son, he was about to get the shit beat out of him. Ricardo recognized the approaching figure to be the leader of the gang, Frankie Moreno, whose reputation with the baseball bat had nothing to do with batting averages. Frankie was rangy and lean with ropey muscles. He wore his hair slicked back in a duck's ass, and from May to September, Frankie wore black chinos and a white T-shirt with a pack of Luckies folded into the short sleeve. He had a pachuco tattoo, a dagger dripping blood, on his left forearm. Frankie was quiet, like a snake, and like a snake, he was deadly. Ricardo couldn't believe the utter stupidity with which he had just acted in scooping up a $20 bill and raising the interest of Frankie Moreno. Frankie was suddenly standing below Ricardo, staring up at him with a look Ricardo first did not recognize. Certainly it was one he hadn't expected, and it was moments before he realized that it was respect. So he smiled, and amazingly, Frankie smiled in return. "Hey, kid," Frankie said, "what's your name?"
"Ricardo,"
Ricardo whispered, his throat dry. "Speak up, man, I can't hear you."
"Ricardo."
"Ricardo, I like that name. It's a name of a kid with balls, and Cardo, you got balls. No brains, but balls, which is worth something on the streets, I can tell you." Ricardo didn't know what to do or say, and wisely said nothing. He swallowed, trying to get some saliva to loosen his throat. "Cardo, you gotta understand. You just stole from the gang, and not only from the gang, but from me. I won the 20, so you stole it from me. I can't let that happen in front of the guys. You see what I mean? It's a matter of respect, and respect is a matter of life and death around here. You live here, you've seen it. I let you get away with my 20, what they gonna think? They'll think I'm soft, that I lost my balls, and without balls, no respect. Hear what I'm telling you? So give me the 20, and we'll forget this ever happened. Seriously, no lie. Be smart. What do you say?"
"I respect you."
"If you respect me, man, how come you stole my 20?
"I didn't steal it. It blew under the fence, and I just reached down and got it. I didn't think I would do it. I can't believe I did. I never did anything like this before, really. You can have it back. I'm sorry."
He stretched out his hand, offering the $20 bill. Frankie took a step forward, reached out his hand, and took hold of the money. For a brief second, Ricardo held tight to the bill, and Frankie held tight also, without pulling the money from Ricardo's hand. It was only a second, but in that instant they were bound, linked forever. Then the bill changed hands.
"Okay," Frankie confided. "I'll tell you what. Because you're a kid with balls and because you respect me, I'm going to pay you $1 a week to keep my baseball bat under your front porch. You got to keep an eye on it. You got to take care of it for me. A guy never knows when he's going to need his bat, you understand. Some Mick or Wop might come walking through looking for a fight. So I got to know my bat is handy. Is it a deal?"
"Yes, it's a deal."
"Shake on it," Frankie said, reaching again for Ricardo's hand.
When they joined hands, a dollar slipped into Ricardo's palm. He closed his fist over it. "Good man. And remember, it's always a matter of respect. Know what I'm telling you?"
"Yes," Ricardo answered. "I know."
"Good. I'll get my bat under your porch tonight sometime. You check it each morning and don't tell anyone. That means no one, understand? If it's ever missing, let me know. I gotta know."
He turned and strolled casually toward his gang. Ricardo watched him go, knowing there was respect between them.
He stood on the porch a long time watching the gang shoot craps again, hearing their curses and their sudden laughter. He heard his name, and he knew that moment that someone respected him. His father and mother loved him. He'd always known that, but they didn't respect him. They didn't take his fears seriously. They didn't respect his little pains. They took care of his physical wounds with great care, but they didn't respect him.
There was a difference. Ricardo knew that Frankie didn't love him, but he respected Ricardo. That was a thing to be desired, a thing of which to be proud. Just as Frankie said, by the next morning his bat was in place under the porch, tucked neatly under the bottom step within easy reach. Ricardo pulled it out to examine it. It was a 32-inch blonde ash bat, the 32 stamped into the end of the handle, which was wrapped with black, sticky electrician's tape. The bat was smooth and solid, and it gave Ricardo a sense of power to wield it. He was proud he'd been put in charge of it. From reading Prince Valiant, Ricardo knew he had become squire to Frankie's knight. He told no one of his responsibility, of his understanding with Frankie. He knew that no one in the family could grasp the respect between them or the importance of it. The Saturday before the Halloween wedding, Ricardo found the dead man. He and his two best neighborhood friends, Jesse and Negros, were riding their bikes to the campus of Parker High School when they found him. They almost ran over him where he lay face up in the middle of a bike path they'd worn in the lawn by cutting across when rounding the corner. Leaping from their bikes, they hovered over him, exhibiting that proper respect reserved for the dead. He was an old man, his hair white and matted, his three-day whiskers a gray and white mix. He was large, his belly extended, his shoulders round, his face puffy. His eyes were open, and he stared as if surprised at the moment of death. Negros, tall, thin, dark-eyed, 12 years old, spoke first. "He's dead, all right. I've seen him before. He's from the nursing home, St. Miguel's, where my mother works the night shift." "Why do you think he died?" Jesse asked, prodding the dead man lightly with his foot. "He don't look hurt." Ricardo stood further back than the other two, afraid. "He's just old," Negros said, "just old enough to die. Old people are always dying. Most funerals are for old people. They just get old and die. Everything wears out at once. He don't look like he's been beat up or stabbed or anything. He's just dead." Ricardo remained silent, thinking of his grandmother and of the upcoming wedding, now only a week away. "It's a sign," he said, breaking his silence. "A sign of what?" Negros asked. "A sign that Luisa Sanchez's wedding is doomed. My grandmother told me a wedding on El Dia de los Muertos was a bad thing. This proves it, man. Something terrible is going to happen." "Don't be stupid, man. Nothing's going to happen. That's old lady stuff." Jesse's experience with old women was non-existent. "No," Negros contradicted. "Ricardo's right. Grandmothers know that kind of stuff. You got to pay attention to them. They know a lot about that spiritual stuff. My grandma knows all the ritual of the Catholic Church, man. She knows what it means and how it all got started after Jesus died on the cross. Church stuff is really old. That's why grandmothers know about it. They're so old." "So what do you think about this old man? Who do we tell?" Jesse asked. "The cops?" "Don't be stupid. Not the cops. Let's go down to St. Miguel's. He's from there. They'll come and get him, but somebody should stay with him." "Why?" Jesse laughed. "He ain't going nowhere." They all laughed. "Don't be a stoop," Negros countered. "It's respect for the dead. One of us has got to stay with him. Make sure he's all right." "What do you mean, all right?" Ricardo asked. "Hell, I don't know. I just know it's the right thing to do." "Okay," Ricardo nodded, and surprised himself by saying, "I'll stay with him." So Negros and Jesse rode off, leaving them alone, Ricardo and the dead old man, to wait for someone to come and take him home. And while they waited, Ricardo talked to the old man as if the man were waiting to die rather than already dead. "You don't look frightened or in pain." "No, I am neither frightened nor in pain," the voice of the dead man answered comfortingly. "I lived too long as an old man to be frightened, and the pain was so brief I really didn't mind it. I suppose one has to expect some pain in payment for the end of all pain. It was a small price to pay, really. I will never have to be frightened nor in pain ever again. It is a comforting thought, don't you think?" See, but weren't you afraid to die alone instead of in the nursing home where someone could have helped you?" "I needed to die here in the outdoors on the damp earth, surrounded by the colorful leaves of the trees, which too are dying. I have been confined in the nursing home too long, so I came out here to die. Autumn days are so refreshing. Ricardo looked around him at the orange and golden leaves, some clinging stubbornly to the tree branches, others resting softly on the ground, having reached the destination they were born to reach.
It's nice here, Ricardo agreed. I always liked the fall until my grandmother told me to fear El Día de los Muertos.
She didn't say to fear it, the voice of the old man reproached him. She said it was bad luck to marry on that day. It is the day of the dead, reserved for us, not a day on which to marry. Surely she is right. As a wedding day, it can come to no good. But you have nothing to fear. You are merely a spectator of this wedding. Your wedding will be much different.
How do you know? Ricardo asked.
You wouldn't get married on El Día de los Muertos, would you?
Of course not, Ricardo insisted.
Ricardo heard voices and turned to see Jesse, Negros, and a nurse from the nursing home hurrying down the sidewalk. He stepped back from the old man.
Are you all right? The woman asked.
We are both all right, Ricardo whispered. The night before the wedding, All Saints Eve, the Devil's Night, Ricardo spiked a fever and began to vomit.
Es el Día de los Muertos, Ricardo's grandmother explained.
It's the excitement of Halloween, his mother put in. It's a pain in the ass, his father said, when Ricardo threw up for the third time. Late in the night, after Ricardo finally found sleep, his grandmother shuffled quietly into his room and slid a raw egg in a saucer under his bed. When he awakened in the morning, the fever had broken. He was, however, as pale as the ghosts that would roam the streets that evening, and he was too weak to attend the Sanchez wedding.
No wedding, no trick-or-treats, his father warned.
Tu es malo, Ricardo's mother scolded. You are so bad. Leave the boy alone. He is better here with me. I'll take care of him. You shouldn't go to the wedding, any of you.
Oh, Ma, don't be such an old woman.
You have no respect, she said. Ricardo was aware that he'd heard an awful lot about respect in the last week. He and Frankie respected one another, and he waited with the dead man out of respect. And now Ricardo's grandmother was telling her son that he didn't have any. Ricardo was amazed. If anyone else had said that to his father would have kicked him down the stairs. Throughout the morning, Ricardo and his grandmother played checkers while he sipped a hot Mexican tea she made up for him. Ricardo never could beat his grandmother at checkers, despite the fact that she didn't know how to play the game. Whenever her pieces began to get dangerously few, she would suddenly jump her own pieces horizontally to avoid being captured or to capture his pieces and sweep his checkers from the red and black squares without mercy.
Abuela, you can't do that, is what you do.
No, no, not that way. Then Ricardo would explain slowly, and she would nod and say, Sí, sí, yo comprendo. They would begin playing again until she was in danger of losing, when she'd move horizontally once more and empty the board. Ricardo and his grandmother knew something was wrong when they heard the family return before noon. The wedding was supposed to begin at 11, followed by a grand reception for the wedding party in the basement of the rectory next to the church. The party should have kept them until 3 o'clock at least, but his father's Dodge pulled into the alley behind the house at 11:45, and while the family was still in the car, Ricardo and his grandmother could hear the keening which only comes with death.
Madre de Dios, she whispered, crossing herself.
Ricardo clung tightly to her skirts. The wailing came from all but his father, who tried in vain to comfort his family as he shepherded them into the house. Ricardo was afraid to ask, but his grandmother needed to know whom death had claimed.
¿Quién es muerto?
Becoming the voice of an ancient chorus, Ricardo's father began his tale. One of the ushers, a young guy, was stabbed by an uninvited guest who crashed the wedding. The usher tried to send him away, tried finally to throw him out. It was stupid. First, we heard them scuffling and turned to see. And then girls and women were screaming, and the usher called out, You stabbed me, you son of a bitch. Oh, God, oh, my God, I'm bleeding so much. We stood up, trying to see, but everyone else was standing, too, and we couldn't really see what was happening. Then more screams, more scuffling as the others tried to help, tried to save the usher, tried to grab the killer and take the knife from him. Finally, the killer was taken from the church. A police car was nearby. Someone ran into the street calling for them. Instead of wedding vows, the priest performed last rites. His name? What was the name of the dead? Ricardo's grandmother insisted. I didn't know him, her son answered. Nobody we knew. One of those pachucos who hangs out on the corner. Frankie something, I don't know. From behind her skirts, Ricardo's grandmother heard a most terrible cry. It was the sound of a boy whose heart had been broken.
No, not Frankie. Not Frankie. Oh, abuela, oh, grandma, not Frankie.
Before anyone could respond, Ricardo was running from the house, down the front stairs, and diving under the front porch, wailing his dirge to Frankie Moreno, who'd respected him, and who was the dead on El Día de los Muertos, and who would always be dead, not just this day, but every day, with every Halloween as a reminder. It took them almost 2 hours to get Ricardo out from under the porch. And then it was his grandmother who was able to reach him. Even she, however, could not wrest the baseball bat from his hands, a baseball bat no one in the family knew the origin of, never having seen it before. But he wouldn't relinquish it, not even while sleeping. Both his mother and his grandmother tried to open his hands to slip it away, but he awakened screaming, "I promised Frankie I'd watch it! I promised!" Ricardo had not gone to the wedding, but he did go to the funeral mass and wondered at the relationship between weddings and funerals, which were held in the same place, performed by the same priest under the watchful eyes of the same God. After the year of the Sanchez wedding, however, he entered autumn a little hesitantly, knowing the dying of the leaves meant death itself could stand with him in the garden or accompany him to the corner for an evening paper. As October lengthened along with the shadows, when he normally focused on the World Series, Ricardo seemed to walk more slowly toward corners and hilltops, as if anticipating the finding of a dead man just beyond his line of vision. His friends noticed his hesitancy and his sudden reluctance to run with them under long railroad overpasses and through dark gangways yelling like banshees, straining the limits of their pre-pubescent voices. But being his friends, they slowed down a little and waited for him to catch up. That was El Día de los Muertos by me, Mike Aleman. Thank you so much for listening to The Bookshelf. We look forward to joining you again tomorrow.
We've just heard the second of the Mike Aleman stories that we're going to hear this week, and they certainly have to do with growing up in Chicago, and they also have to do with his father's side of the family from Mexico. And so, Mike, describe both your father and your grandfather to us.
They were two peas in a pod. They were both very stubborn, typically macho, Hispanic macho. They both drank terribly, and they were as inflexible as a steel rod. And my mother was German, and although she was stubborn, we really did live in a Mexican culture in the home. I didn't develop a good relationship with my father until I was 15, and we moved west to Wyoming, the two of us in a car and then alone for 2 months. At home, he was distant. For example, he read the newspaper during dinner, so he didn't have to visit. He was demanding, and if we did something wrong, he would say, "The older you get, the dumber you get." And I knew when I was 20, I'd be a complete idiot. He was very kind and loving and good when he was not drinking. And he was helpful with neighbors and children. But when he was drinking, it was truly a different personality. Mm-hmm. My grandfather, on the other hand, was always a difficult personality. He was never kind to anyone that I knew of, except my grandmother. She was about 4'9" or 10", and they spoke only in Spanish, but he was always kind to her no matter what. I never heard him raise his voice or curse at her or anything, despite the fact that he would leave her for a year to 2 years at a time. So we lived in a Mexican culture. We made tamales over one weekend in November, for example. The whole family came in, and we all had jobs, and we made dozens of tamales. And my grandmother ruled the roost, and the men could not leave the property once the process started. And they obeyed that. They brought in their beer and their wine on Friday and to get them through to Monday. And it was a delightful time, really. It was one of the few times that everybody seemed to be on the right page.
Well, you have two poems that have to do with your father one way or another. Let's start with Father and Son.
Father and Son. We stand in a black and white photo, side by side, my father and I, on a porch in 1965, our hands folded together in front of us, the only visible likeness we shared at the time. His hair was a blend of salt and pepper, mine black. He weighed 225 pounds, 100 more than I. I'm pleased, however, to see in the photo that I had achieved an inch on him, a benchmark I was as proud of as his pride in my education. Today, at 75, I see more of him looking back at me in the morning mirror than ever before, and I wonder, were he to see a photo of us side by side today, would he know the old man with whom he was standing?
Now let's hear Shining the Winter Shoes.
Shining the Winter Shoes. It was a task my father demanded of me, and although as a boy I resented both his tone and the work, in my aging I've grown to appreciate it. Like changing the tires over each spring and fall, it has become a ritual to mark the turning of the seasons while bringing back memories of my father, who fought too many battles he would have been wise to walk away from. But walking away was never his way, and too often he spoke to other men in the same tone he used with me to polish his winter shoes. I'm amazed at the dust that covers them after sitting all season on the closet floor. So before applying polish with an old toothbrush, I wipe them clean, and after a few minutes to let the polish set, buffing them to a sheen becomes the reward. I think of the words of wisdom my father doled out without practicing them himself. Get a good steady job and keep it. Never, ever drink and drive. Were he alive, he would resent the mention of it. But since he's been gone now 40-plus years, and I need not ask his permission, no harm will come in the telling, and I can enjoy the memories that come while I finish my task.
So these are poems by Mike Ailman that have to do with the patrilineal side of his family, his father and his grandfather. Mike Ailman will conclude his mostly autobiographical stories tomorrow and the following night.